Our final case for argument this morning is United States against Logan. Mr. Coe.
May it please the court, Rick Code from Federal Defender Services of Wisconsin. I represent the appellant in this case, James Logan. A literal reading of the restored provision offends common sense and produces an absurd result based on the legislative purpose of that amendment.
I'm having a problem because I'm wondering why we should read the language of the statute contrary to its plain meaning, particularly given that he retains other options under the statute, such as the ability to seek an expungement or a pardon.
Well, I think what will happen in the majority of cases if the court adopts the McGrath approach is that McGrath only solves the problem of defending against felons who never lose their rights. And I don't think that occurs very often. It occurred in Vermont, and I think that that's an anomaly. Otherwise, I think that the McGrath reading leaves most misdemeanants out in the cold.
But isn't there yet the potential of for disparity, regardless of how we interpret the provision? I mean, based on the differences in state law, and your interpretation, it seems, would give an undue advantage, you know, to Mr. Logan over similar offenders in other jurisdictions in which misdemeanors entail the relinquishment of civil rights.
Well, I think actually Mr. Logan is at a disadvantage in a state where rights are not lost for misdemeanors. I know in Illinois and in Indiana, I believe the right to vote is temporarily lost even with a misdemeanor. Wisconsin.
There are some states where felons don't lose the right to vote. In your view, does that mean that felons in those states can, as a matter of federal law, go around possessing weapons?
I think that would be a consequence of that interpretation. But I think
if you want to throw the word absurd around, wouldn't that be absurd?
But I think that it's a rare, if not improbable, case versus a misdemeanor like Logan.
I think there are 10 states, maybe 11, that do not deprive felons of their right to vote, their right to hold office, and so on.
Which leaves the majority of states revoking their civil rights.
It just seems very unlikely that this statute distinguishes and says everybody, you know, even if you're a convicted bank robber or a convicted murderer in state X, you're, as a matter of federal law, entitled to carry a firearm if state X allows murderers to continue voting.
Well, I think that what the federal law does is it allows the states to determine who is trustworthy enough to carry a firearm. And if you look at trustworthiness, if you compare, for example, if you compare three individuals, one who...
I don't think almost no one is trustworthy enough to continue carrying firearms, and that includes the police.
Well, I would agree with your honor, but I think there's...
Let me come back to your opening, Sally. When you say that something is absurd, what do you mean by that? You mean that there is some linguistic garble in the text where a letter has been dropped and so the text means the opposite of what it seems to say? Or are you saying it just produces odd and jarring consequences that we don't like?
I think it's the latter mostly, but I do think...
All right, well, then are you aware? Neither side seems to be aware that this court held in a case called Jaskolski against Daniels that the latter kind of claim, the substantive absurdity claim, is never tenable, that the absurdity doctrine is exclusively a linguistic doctrine, and that unless there's some linguistic garble, a court can never call the result absurd. And shortly after that, the Tenth Circuit went en banc to consider that, and they agreed 12-0 that we were right in Jaskolski. So your whole argument depends on getting us to overrule Jaskolski, which seems a little difficult.
Well, I didn't finish my sentence. I do think that it seems to me, when you read the statutory provision in question, that Congress did not fail to consider the misdemeanants who I'm talking about, and that language restored.
Statutory language is poorly chosen all the time, but if that were a ground on which the judges could do something else, we'd really be in charge. Wouldn't be any such thing as a distinction between the legislative and the judicial function. All we'd say is, well, you know, poorly written, we're going to do our own thing.
I don't know.
That's why we said in Jaskolski that the absurdity doctrine is limited to linguistic garbles, no substantive component to it.
I guess, in my opinion, the results of that this produces comes from a linguistic garble. I think the provision.
What's the linguistic problem? You already told me when I asked you this question that it wasn't a linguistic problem.
I said it most.
It's perfectly comprehensible English.
It is, but I think that the legislative intent directly contradicts an interpretation.
How is the legislative intent evidenced? I always get worried by suggestions that we take unguided tours inside the heads of members of Congress. There's no telling what you'll find there. So how is this intent evidenced?
Well, I think the congressional record, I think it's evidence, number one, it came about to overrule Dickerson.
No, look, is there some, it would be interesting if there is some legislative history, a committee report that says, and what we mean by this language is that people who never had their civil rights taken away under state law are entitled to continue possessing firearms as a matter of federal law. Then we'd have to figure out the weight to be given to such a statement. Is there such a statement?
I believe if you look at the provision, I don't believe there is an exact statement, but I think if you look at the provisions of the statute, I think if you look at the provisions of the statute, it expands gun ownership rights. It expands the trade of guns. It makes it easier to. So you're talking about a piece of legislation that intended to expand gun ownership rights, and so it doesn't make sense to interpret it this way.
I don't want to confuse the issue here, but I thought.
I think it's confused enough, Your Honor.
Yeah. There's no question that the 1991 felony conviction is the basis for the conviction here of being a felon in possession. He cannot possess a gun because he has that 91 felony conviction. The issue is, as I understood it, it's whether these three misdemeanor, sort of enhanced repeater misdemeanor charges could be used as a basis for branding him an armed career criminal. Your argument, as I understand it, whether we accept it or not, is that because he didn't lose his civil rights
For those convictions,
he can never have them get the benefit of restoration of those rights. So those convictions can't be used, not to authorize him to possess a firearm, but to enhance his sentence as an armed career criminal.
Correct. The statutory provision, the definition in 921A20, applies both to the enhancement penalties of 924E and for the ability for the government to prosecute under 922G1. Your Honor is correct. I am arguing that those predicate convictions that predated his felony conviction should not be able to be counted for the reasons Your Honor stated. And it looks like my light is on. If there are no further questions, I'll save time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Ms. Romolo.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rita Romolo for the United States. As this court recognizes, Congress intentionally keyed the restoration of civil rights to state law, and Congress made the decision, therefore, to accept anomalous results. It's just going to happen. Every state differs. And in this particular case, Mr. Logan was convicted of...
Has there been any litigation about the effect of felony convictions in those states that never take away the right to vote or the right to hold public office, where indeed, as in Boston, being elected from prison is a perfectly normal thing for mayors. See Mayor Curley.
I'm not aware a mayor was elected from prison.
Oh, yes. That's one of the things that made Mayor Curley famous.
Wow.
He was reelected while he was in prison.
It wasn't the Indelicato decision just the issue, presented the issue that the court just asked about. There, a defendant was convicted of an enhanced or an aggravated misdemeanor, and the government prosecuted him solely on that basis. It was distinguishable from this case. We prosecuted Mr. Logan because he is, without a doubt, a convicted felon, as we've always thought of the term felon, a crime punishable by a term of imprisonment exceeding 1 year, instead of the aggravated or enhanced misdemeanors. And so he is prohibited. But in Delicato, it was just the government prosecuted the defendant solely based upon the enhanced misdemeanor conviction. And, of course, as we know, the First Circuit in that decision said, government can't do that. And I think that that was the wrong decision because, as this court has recognized, the statute can't be any more plain. Mr. Logan retained his civil rights. They were never taken away, therefore they cannot be restored. And so given the plain language of the statute, Mr. Logan was definitely permissibly sentenced as an armed career criminal in this case. And I ask the court to affirm the judgment and conviction of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Rumbelow. Anything further, Mr. Cohn?
Just briefly, Your Honor. If the court doesn't find that this produces an absurd result, I would characterize it at the very least as being contrary to common sense. And it is...
From my perspective,
that's
probably
absurd.
About 15 linear feet of the United States Code fits that definition.
Judge, Your Honors, a misdemeanant who never loses his civil rights should not be less protected from the prosecution of the federal government than a felon who's been supposedly restored by our prison system. And to answer specifically Your Honor's question about stated purposes of the statute, the one that I do have is Senator Hatch stating that the purpose of legislation was to protect firearm owners' constitutional rights, civil liberties, and rights to privacy. I rarely quote Senator Hatch from my political perspective, but I think in this case it's clear what the intent of the statute was, and that's all. Thank you.
Well, it's obvious that appeals arguments make strange bedfellows.
They do.
Indeed. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.